Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. And if you're just starting to hear my voice around right now, it means you have discovered that my introduction plus the music is always 30 seconds. And as soon as you start listening, you can hit 30 seconds forward and not miss anything and just skip the introduction. Anyway, so today I'm going to be reviewing the second book in a series, although it's not really a second book in a series, it's pretty much like the second half of a single story that started with Ada Palmer's To Like the Lightning, and which I reviewed a few episodes ago, and this is the second book of the Terra Ignota series, book number two, called Seven Surrenders. Apparently there's like another two books already planned after this one, although I'm not sure I'm that much interested in reading them, because it's not often that you'll read a first book which ends really abruptly and you'll be like, oh no, I wish there was a second, but I can't wait for it, and then you're like, oh, it's already out, so you read it, and then it continues a story perfectly and then finishes up and answers all the questions that were left over from the first book in such a great way that I'm just like, oh, that's the end of the main story. I don't really need anything else. And that's what this book feels like for me. It's not like, you know, Hyperion, where you read that first book and you go, oh, that was really great, interesting storytelling, and then the second book is so bad that you just want to, you don't want to read it anymore. And so many times a second book in a series will like fall very far short or be a completely different book than the first book. These two books though, Seven Surrenders follows up with from Two Like the Lightning in such a seamless way that it really is just one book. The characters are exactly the same characters, like they end one book and it's sort of like the next book picks up 5 minutes later and they just carry on. There is a tiny little bit of, oh, this is what happened at the end of the last book and here's some characters that you might need to know, but it's very, very minimal. It's very much like just one book. Now, I do think the quality of this second book isn't as high as the first book in terms of writing and some of the character development and the, you know, just different world building stuff. It's not as good as the first book because everything there was so fresh, the characters were so new, everything was really interesting. And this is sort of like, okay, now there was lots and lots of things that were brought up in that first book and we don't know the answers to them, and now here are the answers, and here's some more plot, and here's some twists, and here's some turns, and here's some shifting political alliances, and then it all goes all the way through to the end. And finishes up with Mycroft Canner, who is our main character, who also our, he's like, well, he says he's not the protagonist of the story, but is very much sort of like our guide through the story, and he is our in-book narrator, like it, within the book himself, he is saying, ah, I am writing this book to you, the reader, and this person is contributing this thing, and this person contributing this thing, but I'm putting it all together, and it actually gets to the end of the thing, and now this is the book that I'm writing. It's a few months after this week-long event that took place in Two Like the Lightning and Seven Surrenders, and yeah, now we're going to see how it goes. So it feels like the story is done. The world has changed in a way, and the reason why he wrote this book about this 1 week of events, it's sort of like, okay, it's obvious that that is a very important week of events. It starts with this thing, it ends with this thing. We get lots of backstory all included to explain all the different bits and pieces. And it's very satisfying on a story level if I think it is a little bit of a dip in quality of writing. However, the way that this book finishes off that first book is so exciting and so interesting to me because I was such a fan of the first book. It's one of those things that the first book I was like, I think I gave it, in fact I can't remember exactly how many stars I gave it, but I think it was like, oh, that's a 4-star book, and if the second book pays it off, it will be, you know, it'll be overall it'll be like a 5-star. So what did I give it? Yeah, 4.5 stars I gave to Terra Ignota. But you know, I couldn't give it 5 stars because it wasn't the full story. And now that the full story is out, I think the story itself, there are some weaknesses and some of the characters do drop off a bit, and because there's just so much crammed into this second book, but it doesn't make me regret giving that first book a really high rating. Sometimes I'll give a first book in a series a really high rating and the second and third book or something, it just all falls apart and I'm like, oh, I don't even want to bother finishing this. But this one really holds together. Like, if you liked the first book, you're gonna mostly like this book. If you hated the first book, you're gonna really hate this book even more because it's even a bit more bizarre. So if you're just listening to this and you think, oh, what is it all about? Well, I don't want to give too much away. And this is always the problem about reviewing a second book in a series. I could explain everything that happened in the first book and say, and this book continues it. And when I first looked up this, the blurb on Goodreads literally said, like, in the first part, it was like, here is what happens. Here is the massive revelation that happens in the very last chapter of the first book. And now this is the world that we're set in. And I complained about it at the end of my previous review, saying, don't look up the blurb on Goodreads for book number two. It gives away massive plot spoilers and kind of what the whole first book is building to. But now they've actually changed the blurb on Goodreads, which I'm very pleased with as well. So this is what it says here. It's a world in which near instantaneous travel from continent to continent is free to all, in which automation now provides for everybody's basic needs, in which nobody living can remember an actual war, in which it is illegal for three or more people to gather for the practice of religion, but ecumenical senseis minister in private one-on-one, in which gendered language is archaic and to dress as strongly male or female is, if not exactly illegal, deeply taboo, in which nationality is a fading memory and most people identify with their choice of the seven global hives, distinguished from one another by their different approaches to the big questions of life. And it is a world in which, unknown to most, the entire social order is teetering on the edge of collapse. So it is definitely a utopian system, a post-scarcity world, and it's really difficult, or it's often difficult to write about these utopian post-scarcity worlds when you're actually just living in them, because it's like, okay, where's the drama? Where are the big questions? Like, what are people actually working on? And Ian M. Banks kind of plays around with this idea, or kind of talks about this idea in his culture series, where the people who live in the culture, they're like, well, what do I do? Well, I'm going to learn how to play games, and I'm going to learn a musical instrument, and I'm going to become a world expert in this, and I'm going to travel and do this kind of thing. And everybody has to find their own things to do in life, and you definitely get that in this book. I really enjoy the idea of vocateurs, people who are like amateur work people, because everyone has to work a little bit, you know, but some people decide, I'm going to work full time at my job just because I love my job so much, and some people get really good at being experts at one thing or another thing, and there's people who are vocateur police people or detectives. They're just really good at their job, and so they're the one who are assigned the cases and things. And so I really enjoy that idea. But of course, the best way to make a utopia interesting is to break it in some way, is to say, okay, well, how can we push this past the limits of what's going to happen? And the first book was really setting up those questions. We already knew that not everything was... there was something rotten under the surface of this, and it's kind of exposed little bit by little bit. And then at the end of the first book, it's exposed in a big way, and you're like, oh, right, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And in this book, it's sort of like, oh, and you thought it was rotten there, okay, let's go have a look over at this hive, this big cast with billions of people living in it. Does it really work as well? Oh no, maybe that's corrupt. And over here, what about these people? Oh, maybe they're double crossing each other. So the way that the second book is kind of layer upon layer of showing how the thing that everyone thinks is this post-scarcity utopia and everyone's living in peace and everyone's happy and death is, you know, people are living longer and longer and accidental deaths are being reduced down and down by the utopians. The utopians is one of the hives, but the other hives are going, oh, we're very good at this, we're very humanitarian over here, we're very good scientists, we're very good at sports, and the humanists are very good at sports and kind of like personal individualist growth and things, and all these different places. Oh, there was the Greenpeace as well, is become one of the hives, and they're like, oh, we're looking after all of India is now just a reservation, and all of Africa is just a reservation, and North America, not mentioned very much in the books. Does North America exist anymore, or has that been wiped out by one of the wars? You know, it's kind of these little hints that are dropped all the way through. So yeah, you think, okay, everyone's striving for a better world, but then when it's actually revealed, like, what is the cost of this world, and is that cost worth it? And that's where a lot of the conflict comes from. Like, you know, there's a better world possible, in the past, a better world was seen as possible. What were the sacrifices to reach this better world? And in the future, there's going to be another better world that's possible. So do we have to sacrifice what's happening now to get to that better world in the future? And those are the the themes that are kind of playing through these political undercurrents. On top of that, there are these hives, and there's different people involved in these hives, and some of them want more power, and some of them want less power, but most of them want more power, and some people want more power very specifically, and so there's lots of political double-crossing. I was talking to Juliana in the last episode, and she was like, oh, I'm not really interested in the political side of some things like who's in charge or who's doing that, you know, that doesn't really interest me. Which means she would hate this book because, like, I'd say about 40% of Seven Surrenders is kind of like people scheming to, you know, this person's going to be working that person, that means that person's going to be more powerful, and then that person's going to be more powerful over there. You know, it's just so much of that that's what this book is about, and how the smaller actions that were playing out and the smaller revelations in the first book play through in to this book. And that's one of the things that I find really impressive about this. I mean, it's just so audacious. The world building and the story and the characters and the way that things are described in this book is just really, I don't know, audacious is the only word I can say, because there's just so much thrown into this, so much world building, so many characters, so many ideas. And they're not all just paid off in that first book. So many things were set up in that first book where, like, for example, there was this one character called Sniper, and they keep saying Sniper, and they're like, your middle name is Cardigan, and he doesn't like his middle name, he just wants to be called Sniper. And all the way, literally the entirety of the first book, they talked about Sniper, his second name, and his middle name, and how he doesn't like to be called by his middle name. But then, like, why is his first name never mentioned? And that, all the way through the first book, I was like, there must be something important. Well, it wasn't, like, all the way through, but it was when I kept on going, I keep talking about his middle name, but not his first name. What's important about his first name? I don't get it. And then in this book, like, you know, just near the start of it, a quarter of the way into it or something like that, they suddenly go, oh, yes, and your first name is this, and it's very important for this. And I was like, there it is. Got it. Right, now I understand what it's going. Every single one of his names is important. Like, his first name that begins with O is important, and his middle name, Cardigan, and then his final last name, Sniper. Why is he called Sniper? Oh, he's called Sniper because he used to, you know, that's a family name, but also he lives up to the name in that he was a pentathlete and he did shooting. He was a sharpshooter, a pistol shooter, and he could swim and he could run and he could, what's the other one? Horse ride. And I can't remember what the other pentathlon sport is. But yeah, you could do all the modern pentathlon. And all of these different kind of things. And that's just one character. And then you're like, and all the time they were talking about the OS. And I was like, what's the OS? Why do they keep calling the Sania Weeksbooth Barsh, this family unit which controls the flying cars around the world, why do they keep calling them the OS, the OS problem? And it's like one of the major things in that first book, the OS. And it's only like halfway through, well, again, maybe not halfway through, but a third of the way into this book, where it goes, okay, it's called the OS because of this. And then you're like, oh, that means this thing over here is really important, this thing over here is really important. And it's just so great that all of these things were obviously set up. This was a full, complete story. And then it was split into two novels, but so many of the things that could have been paid off at the end of the first novel, or they were talked away through. And it just makes the world so rich that all these things are kind of thrown in there, and it's not really explained by our main character, Mycroft Canner, like what he did or what he was talking about like that. And it's just sort of like later on you just go, oh, that makes sense because of this. But of course he, as a character within the book telling us his story, doesn't realize that we don't know that, or he doesn't realize that that's not the important thing, and he doesn't realize whatever going on. So it's only revealed later, kind of by the by. And so many of the things that come into this book which are just kind of revealed, oh, I guess this is important, maybe, or, oh, I'm just going to mention this in a side comment, and you're like, wow, suddenly, like, two chapters in the first book suddenly make way more sense, and, oh, that's why this character changed quite a lot here, and there's even a section at the end where they say, and again, it's a weird thing to say, that Mycroft Canner, like, why he is a servitor. In other words, if you kill someone or if you've done a really bad crime, you are punished by becoming a servicer, and you have to just live out your life doing the work of other people. Important people say, oh, we need some help with this, you're going to do some gardening for me, or we need some, you know, paperwork done, I want you to fill out this paperwork, and you can request a servicer to come in and help you out. And there's lots of these people around, And you think, well, why is he a servicer? What did he do? And I can't remember if it was revealed at the end of the first book or at the beginning of this book, but it goes into a lot more depth about why, like, who he was and why he was like that. And then his character changes, and it's only at the very end of this book you're like, oh, maybe that explains. And he's like, oh, maybe that explains why I'm different. Maybe I was, you know, all these different kind of things and these different character moments in the first book, which are kind of referenced and then referenced throughout. I suddenly, like, again, they're not explained, not always explained explicitly, but just a few things are thrown in there, like what, you know, why is the Senir Weekspooth Barsh so important and all that kind of stuff. It just keeps coming back. And also there's this character called there's this one character who has so many different names in the first book. It's sort of like he has, and you work out, oh, he's got seven different names because all of the different hives, these big tribes of billions of people who, you know, do this here and do that there, they all give him a different name. And so his name is J-E-D-D Mason, and Mason is one of the tribes, one of the hives, sorry, one of these factions. But it's sort of like, why J-E-D-D Mason? And they keep on referring to him as J-E-D-D Mason and Jed and other things. And then it's sort of like, oh, actually, it stands for this, 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 and then Mason. And you're like, oh, okay, all of those things, he's got seven different names depending on who is talking to him or who makes a claim to this one character. And of course, he becomes, as his extra names are revealed, how important he is gets more, and you know, it's revealed that he's more and more important as we go through. What else do I want to say here as well? Oh yeah, this book, and I mentioned it in the first book, it plays a lot with gender and, you know, gender pronouns. I mentioned in the first book how they is a good word, except that you don't only get ambiguity on gender. It talks, you know, there's always an ambiguity comes in on plural, singular or plural, because it could be both. And then there's some characters in this where they're sort of like, oh, is it hermaphrodite? And suddenly these are being, instead of they, it's sort of like, oh, and this character is now it does this, it does that, it. And I'm like, no, you can't call them an it. It's a person. It's hermaphrodite. But then I'm like, oh, this is weird. Like, you know, this book is set, you know, however many hundreds of years in the future, and this language has changed. And you also get, you know, they as well. But also the idea of kind of like when gender is rejected, like what then becomes the base? Is it going to be, do you treat everyone exactly 50% male and 50% female, depending on, like, and if they dress up or not dress up, or dress as, or if they act more female or not more female? And I kind of enjoy, I don't think I agree with all of the conclusions that this book comes to, but I enjoy the exploration of, like, what would it mean if nobody wants to identify as male or female, and if you do, it's kind of frowned upon. But then, like, where does masculinity go and where does femininity go? How are those expressed, or can they be expressed? Or if they are kind of pushed down and people don't want to express them, is that good or is that bad? And all of that is kind of played out. And again, I don't really agree with what conclusions it draws. But again, I'm not sure if that is a fault of... I'm not sure if that's Mycroft Canna, the in-universe narrator, talking about that, or Ada Parma talking about that, or if it's sort of like the distant view, future view of, you know, very screwed-up people in a distant future, which is itself screwed up. It's kind of so alien to me, I'm just, like, not even quite sure which way the author is leaning, which way the characters are leaning, which way society in the future is leaning, and also what I'm meant to be thinking about this kind of thing, because there are the narrator is so unreliable that so many things that he even said in the first book is sort of like, oh, you'll think I'm not being reliable, that I'm talking about these miracles, but these miracles couldn't possibly happen, though, could they? Could they happen? I'm not sure. And that's kind of brought through with it, like, how much Mycroft Canna as the narrator stops, like, doesn't reveal to us and then does reveal to us. In some ways he's playing with us, toying with us as an audience, as a reader. I say he, this is what Ada Parma is doing via Mycroft Canna, the in-universe narrator of this book, or writer of this book. But yeah, it's a very tricky thing, to the point where he has now finished this story. Mycroft has finished his story of these 7 days leading up to these world-changing events, and he says, oh, I, you know, this is what happens, and that's what happened, and this is what happened, and now there's my story, and now it's a few months later, let's see how things play out in the future. I really hope And this is where my previous hopes were, oh, when it comes to a second book in a series, can't the second book in the series just be like more of the first? And the other way to do it, if you're not going to just do more of the first and you're going to change the storytelling style and the concept of the novel or the conceit of the novel so much so, but leave stuff in the future, there's different ways of making me satisfied, either exactly more of the same or different enough that I don't miss what has changed or is missing from the first book in the second book, or replace it with something even better. And what I was talking about with the Broken Earth series is that the first book was so great, then the second and third book had enough of the first book and the continuation of the characters and the story for me to go, this is a continuation of the story, but it missed out so much stuff that I enjoyed about that first book. And I talked about some other books where that happens too. Whereas in this case, it's so close, I'm just like, oh great, that's good. The other way to do it is to just use the same world and some of the same characters, but have it a completely different book with a completely different story. So, and I hope that's what happens with the book 4, 3 and 4 in this Terra Ignota series. I actually really love to see the next story told from a completely different point of view. Told from the point of view of something, you know, like just a character who we haven't even known yet, but also reflecting back on what happened in this 7 week, or so these 7 days, and what happened in the years beforehand, and what other people's opinions of these actions are. Because so much of this book is like, it is very close to the center of power. Like, some of the main character is literally called Caesar. He is the head of this whole hive, and he lives in Alexandria and Nova Roma, and switches between the two, and there's the King of Spain, and then these other people. And the book pretty much starts off, the first book starts off saying, okay, here is a list of the 7 most important people in the world, and here's somebody else's list of the 7, they're called the 7-10 list. They're 7 most important people in the world, plus 3 others who are worth noting, and these are very important. They're very influential, kind of. I guess it's like, is it the Times 100 people of the year or the person of the year? Is that kind of list? So many most influential, or is it the Forbes billionaires list, the richest people in the world? It's kind of those lists. And when you actually read, like, oh, who are the characters who are mentioned on this list? By the end of book 2, we've met all of those characters, and some of them are now major characters. So it's very close to the center of power. And Mycroft, Kanna, and Sniper and these other people are right there in amongst all of that kind of stuff. And I kind of hope, I mean, I'd like to see the next book or the next 2 stories maybe written from the point of view of maybe an utopian who's on the moon looking at this stuff and is like, well, that's all happening down there. I'm going to Mars, and then this stuff that has happened now is like a backdrop of what happens in that other story of saying, like, oh, what happened when people escaped this? And, or maybe, you know, there's different ways it could take, but I kind of hope that the next 2 books aren't just more of the same. It's sort of like, here's more Mycroft Kanna. For example, I never knew that, like, it was never really answered for me if Mycroft Kanna, who is so close to the center of power and gets more power even though he's a murderer and all that kind of stuff, it was never really explained, or it was never revealed to me if he knew the damaging conspiracy in the past. Like, that was revealed at the very end of the first book. It's really important. He's very close to a lot of those people. Did he know about that before? The way he's presenting about it was like, oh, I didn't know about this. This has nothing to do with me. I couldn't know about this at all. But I'm thinking, well, he never said he didn't know about it in the past. He's just writing about it now as though he's just saying, oh, and this is what was found out. And I'm like, yeah, but did you already know that? It's suspicious that you're writing about this in a way that you're trying to imply that you maybe did know about it, but you didn't. You don't want to talk about it or anything like that. So it's that kind of unreliable narrator I really enjoyed, but it does get kind of frustrating because I never really felt like I do have the full story, which is good because it means that there's more to reveal in the later books, but it definitely does wrap up the story from a certain point of view. What else did I actually make any notes? I did make 3 notes. Yes, I really enjoy the idea of, there's some religious stuff as well. Miracles do happen in this book. This is not just pure science fiction, and right at the very start of book 1, it's sort of like, yes, there is miracles in this world. I believe that this person is a god and that there are miracles. And this is what this story is going to be about. Lots of people say that they don't believe in miracles, but for this story to work, you've got to believe in this miracle. But again, it also allows you to go, oh, maybe it's not a miracle, maybe it's a thing, but actually, no, it is a miracle. So it's quite fun to actually read about people interacting with miracles and with godlike figures. Bridger, who is omnipotent but not omniscient, and is, you know, is a child and not wanting to... This is not a spoiler, by the way. It's the first chapter of the first book. Bridger can convert toys into living beings, and some of the main characters, or some of the important characters in this story are toys that have been, like, these little toy soldiers that have been made into humans, or they are now acting, but I mean, they're like little Lilliputian kind of size things, and they're very important parts of the story. And later on, the different characters or different things do become more, and some less, but more of them become more important. You're like, okay, this story only works with these characters existing, so these miracles do happen. And then there's another character who is very godlike, who seems to be omniscient, but isn't omnipotent, has no powers except human powers, but has kind of like the perception and a route into the knowledge, into knowledge of other people, and knowledge of good and evil, like godlike beings, and yeah, so there's this interplay, the whole thing of like gods can be omniscient, and if they're both omniscient and omniscient, can they make a rock which is too big for them to lift, and all these different kind of ideas, which if God is only in one being, it's really tricky. And there's contradictions and all that kind of stuff, but you separate it out into two beings or whatever, and then you're like, oh, okay, how these interplay and what individual facets of a single god can do. And there's some fun theology stuff in this book discussing that kind of stuff. Again, don't need to get into it now, but I do enjoy that stuff happening in a book, because if this was just a straight science fiction book, most of it could work, and it would just be a normal book. But I think the element of theology and gods existing and miracles happening, I know, it just throws extra craziness into this book. And to wrap up this review, this is what I really like about this book. And I've said this before about other science fiction books and other fantasy books. I really like it when an author is just like, okay, I've thought of a crazy idea, it's going in the book. Oh, here's another crazy idea, that's going in the book. Here's something else, that's going in the book. Now, if you only do like 4 or 5 crazy ideas in a book, and then it's 2 long books put together into a single story like this, it doesn't always hold together. But what I like about this book, and other, I can't think off the top of my head of other examples where they're just like, right, everything's going in there. Like, this idea is going in, this idea is going in, this character sounds a bit weird, it's going in, this thing here is going in. But that, because when you do that, once you put all those ideas in and just go, oh, that's not going to go in. I mean, I'm sure there is some editing. Ada Palmer had some ideas which didn't go in the book, but just the idea, like, just to put all this together, and it could have just been a straight story, but then she's like, no, the writing is going to be a viewpoint character writing a book, talking to you as an author, saying, well, talking to you as a reader, going, dear reader, you may think this is unbelievable, this is what happens. That direct address is great, and the, you know, philosophical digressions and stuff, it just goes, no, it's all going in there, and it allows you to find in a book all the interesting stuff, which could be separated out into a whole series or different authors going in. But I really like the idea of just going, right, no, everything's going in there. It's just all going in. Why wouldn't it all go in? It's interesting. It's going in the book. And allows Ada Palmer to explore these different ideas. Again, some of them are weaker than others. There are some plot points which I'm like, eh, does that work? And I'm like, is it just an unreliable narrator, or is that a plot hole? You know, sometimes I wasn't quite sure. And there's these other, like you say, some of the gender stuff or some of the, you know, race stuff. I'm just like, is that the way it should go? I mean, that's the way it's going in this book. That's what these characters think. But is that what I would do? I'm not sure. Was that how I would think? I'm not sure. But just by throwing it all in there, it kind of just frees you up as a reader just to be, like, taken along for the ride. You don't actually have to concentrate on any one of these little facets. It just moves on. And in this book, there's just really fun characters, and it's laugh-out-loud funny, and sometimes there's some really fun action at the end, which pays off so many things that was like, oh, right, of course that was going to happen. This was being set up in, like, chapter 3 of book number 1, and now it's being, you know, in chapter 6 of book number 2, it's being paid off, and there's so many of those great things all the way through. Again, these minor characters, these toys, as they come back, and how they play into the story. I really enjoyed those later on. So, yeah. Oh, also, this is a cool thing about this book. There was a different audiobook narrator from book 1 to book 2. Let me quickly look up who was the audiobook narrator in this one. Yeah, this was narrated by T. Ryder Smith. And because I just finished the previous book, like 2 books ago, whenever it was, and then went straight into this one, it kind of caught me out at the start, because the first audiobook narrator was so good, and I enjoyed his performance so much. I was like, no author could do this the same, like, no audiobook narrator would be able to do this better. Like, so what? And then it was a different one, and it started off, and I was like, oh, I'm not getting into it. But then the choices that T. Ryder Smith, the audiobook narrator of this one, made, in some ways, I mean, the accents and some of the performances weren't quite as good, but the ideas that he brought into the performance, for example, when you didn't know the gender of a character when they were talking, he managed to put on an inflection in his voice which kind of sounded robotic in some ways. He would be like, and now I do think it should be like this. And you're going, oh, right, this character doesn't have a voice yet. It doesn't have a gendered voice yet. We don't know how old this character is. We don't know what nationality they are or whatever like that. So until that's been revealed within the story, this character isn't going to get a gendered voice or an age voice or an accent voice or an ethnic voice or whatever you want to put in there. And that being developed throughout the audiobook, I was like, oh, this is great. When this character was being referred to as he, it had a more male voice, and then as it went through and that character was then called a she later on, or an it, or whatever, that the voice changed in ways which I was like, oh, this is actually how I should, if I was reading the book, this is what I would be in this kind of like superposition of not knowing gender or age or character of this character, or what's going on with this character. And I guess that's a really tricky thing to play with, and it's done really well in this one. So I do recommend the audiobook. Go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP to get this book for free. Actually, not this book. Get the first one, Two Like the Lightning. And if you sign up for a trial membership there at audibletrial.com/SFBRP, if you use that link, you help support the podcast here as well. Right, I think that's it. So what's the next book that I'm reading? Actually, I'm already halfway through. I only started it yesterday, but this was recommended in the SFBRP listener group over on goodreads.com. Get over there and recommend books to me, because I do read the books if they are recommended. So I'm already halfway through The Girl with All the Gifts by M.R. Carey, narrated by Flinty Williams. I really like the name Flinty Williams. So, Finty. Oh, it's Finty Williams. Yeah, I'm getting mixed up there. So Finty Williams, also a really good name. So halfway through that already, as recommended. So get over to Goodreads and chat to other listeners at the SFBRP listener group there. Also become my friends on Goodreads so I can see what you think of books that I've also read. For example, I haven't... did I rate it? Yeah, I guess I've rated this book. So, Seven Surrenders, here we go. Stevie Kincaid rated it 5 stars. Zivin rated it 3 stars. Veer rated it 5 stars. J.M. Oriole rated it 5 stars. And Odo rated it 5 stars. And other people have marked it as too read. So this has only been read by 4 people. So why didn't Zivin like it? He says, however, in Seven Surrenders, I think I got to chapter 19 out of 24 before anything new happened. Yes, I do understand what he's saying about that, that this is actually like going, oh, okay, this is a lot of the first part of this second book is sort of like filling us in, and you go, actually, you might not have realized it, but this is what happened before. Oh, and here's some more backstory. Yes, so new stuff does happen, but this book is definitely filling in a lot of the details of what's gone before, which is kind of a bit weird, because at the start of this book, our main character kind of gets taken out of the picture for a while. It's sort of like, yeah, I was held in captivity for a day, and then I was ill for a day, and later on I was in hospital for a while, and all this stuff was happening around me. So yeah, it did feel a little bit more filling in the gaps, but I did actually enjoy all of those gaps being filled. At least they were filled. There's very few mysteries from the first book that were left over. But otherwise, yeah, it seems to be kind of highly rated. 4.23 stars on. But again, it's the second book in a series, and if you really hated the first book, you probably didn't pick up this book. It's one of those like ratings being inflated artificially as you go through a series, as only the people who enjoyed the previous book to review and rate this one. So yeah, you can email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email that I get, although I do have a few sitting in my inbox that I've not got back to yet. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge there. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm @LukeBurridge there. You can follow along on YouTube with my juggling videos and vlogging and travel stuff. That all happens at YouTube. I guess my name there is Luke Burridge. Our channel name is Luke Burridge. And, yeah, I think that's about it. So, thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.